Okay.
Some of those interfaces are imperfect.
Mr. Chu, welcome this afternoon. Thanks for being here and applying to be on the Board of Regents. A couple things first. We will ask you to give an opening statement, 5 minutes or so, and also if you have any questions, please ask us. And once you've done your opening statement, we'll have questions from the council. And when we've got about 5 minutes left of our allotted time, we'll have you give a closing statement if you'd like. Any questions?
Nope.
Very good. So play through.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, very good.
Thank you. Don't mind if I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. My name is Michael Chu, and I know by reading my name you don't know how to pronounce it, but it is like the shoe on your foot, as I think Jim communicated before. My U of M story begins with my father. My father came to the university in 1948 from China to pursue his graduate studies in aerospace engineering. He was awarded a Chinese government scholarship at the time. And he had survived the Japanese occupation in China in the 1930s and World War II, and then graduated from one of China's top universities. And he chose Minnesota because it had a good reputation. And this was probably because of the China program that was started in 1914. As a graduate student, he washed dishes at Pioneer Hall, lived a few blocks away from there where there's now a parking ramp. He finished his master's degree in 1949, and that was the same year the communist government took over control of China. He finished his PhD in 1954, and around that time was offered U.S. citizenship if he did not return to China. Lucky for me and my brother, he accepted. He then worked as a junior professor at the aerospace department at the university and also at the aerospace labs in Rosemont. And in 1958, he was recruited and hired to start up the aerospace graduate program at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. Yeah. My mother also came from China via Taiwan to Southern California and then later to Iowa. And her story, I couldn't find a Minnesota connection, so I'm not going to bore you with it. I was born in Ames in the mid-1960s and graduated from Ames High School. My father wanted me to attend the University of Minnesota, and he had listed, without my knowledge, Minnesota as my first-choice college on my national merit scholarship application. He did this before I even knew I thought I could go to the University of Minnesota. This actually proved to be a good move because I eventually received the Elmer L. Anderson National Merit Scholarship. In the 1970s, my parents had purchased an early Apple computer for my brother and me, and it solidified my interest in electronics and computer programming. I became interested in Minnesota because it was highly ranked in electrical engineering. It was number 4 at the time in the country. And it was located in a large city with high-tech computer companies. And, you know, I had hoped to work part-time to pay for school and full-time in the summers to gain residency so I could get resident tuition. And as a freshman, I lived in Frontier Hall, which was known as the Wild Frontier. Although it was all male, so I didn't understand it. But anyway, I participated in the honors program, and I joined a fraternity. And at the fraternity, I made lifelong friends. I met my future wife and also my future business partners. I was able to find employment at Honeywell in the Systems and Research Center as a research aide, where I worked on projects involving solar and fiber optic technologies. And I even worked on some top secret projects, which I didn't have clearance for. But I eventually learned what those were for just recently. After college, I signed on with Arthur Anderson, a large accounting firm with a large consulting division. I was in the consulting division and based in the world headquarters in Chicago. And at Arthur Anderson, I worked on large systems implementations at large banks, manufacturers, retailers, energy companies, and government departments. Later, I transitioned to a leading management consulting firm, which is now owned by PricewaterhouseCoopers. It was known as Booz Allen Hamilton, and I also began attending the University of Chicago Graduate School of Business. At Booz Allen, I worked on strategy and operations projects in addition to cost reduction projects for large organizations in various industries. After getting married, my consulting days were numbered. One day, I received a call from my old fraternity brother who was finishing his MBA at the Carlson School. He asked if I had any ideas for internet startups. This is in the 90s. The timing was good because I was finishing up a project at Netscape, the internet browser company, and we were trying to help figure out if they could survive in light of Microsoft's decision to start giving away their browser, Internet Explorer, for free. Well, Netscape did not survive, but I came away with a lot of ideas for internet startups. So we decided to start an internet reservations company called T-Master, focused on golf reservations. And I've also since worked on various other startups and mentored other entrepreneurs, including U of M students. Recently, I participated in President Kaler's Greek Community Strategic Task Force and served as the co-chair of the alumni sub-work group. During this effort, I learned a lot about the university's operations and also had the opportunity to work with the president's office. As part of the recommendations from the task force, the Minnesota Greek Alumni Council was formed to work with the university to help implement task force recommendations. I was a founding member and became the first president of the organization. I've also participated in the interview process for the new vice provost for student affairs and the dean of students, Benita Brown Young, as well as the new assistant vice provost for student experiences, Lamar Hilton. Over the years, I've been involved in a number of educational K-12 organizations and projects and also mentored university students. The University of Minnesota is one of the most important, if not the most important asset of the state. It prepares men and women for the future and can help solve problems not only for our state but potentially for our country and our world. The Board of Regents is extremely important to the university. It's elected by the legislature to provide oversight, define the mission, hire the president, evaluate the president, set tuition and budgets, approve faculty tenure, confer degrees, etc. The missions of research, teaching and training, and outreach are critical to the future of Minnesota and its citizens. I believe the university is generally moving in the right direction, but I think we can do better. And as a citizen, I'm concerned about a number of things, beginning with tuition. We're getting to the point where college education is getting too expensive for almost everyone. In fact, for a student starting today, it will cost them approximately $100,000, including the total cost of attendance. And I think that's way too high. We were reminded of the administrative cost issue by the Wall Street Journal a few years ago. I think generally there's a lot of administrative costs that are being taken out by President Kaler today. I think $90 million over 6 years, and I think that's great. Additionally, I'm concerned with transparency, access, and diversity, graduation rates, because low graduation rates contributes to even more debt for students, and that's not taking into consideration the opportunity cost of whatever they'd be doing after they graduated. I'm also interested in career placement and the student experience, including housing, health and safety of students on campus. Research and technology is also very important. The transfer and commercialization through public-private partnerships, intellectual property that gets created here, and potential startups. Lastly, I think the rankings of the university are extremely important, and I'd like to see the rankings improve over time. The university is the economic engine for the state. It educates new generations and creates innovations that could one day save the planet. I have a deep interest in agriculture and how we will produce enough food to feed our growing world population. I'm also concerned about how we're going to cure disease and stop pandemics. I live in Blaine with my wife, Erica, my son, Thor, and daughter, Annika. My kids are both in high school and will hopefully be off to college soon. My brother, Stephen, is the Vice President of Research and Graduate Studies at Michigan State University. As you know, we grew up at a land-grant university, and we've had many, many discussions about higher education, and we share a passion for it. I feel right now is the right time for me to seek to serve on the Board of Regents to help shape the future of the university. I believe the next decade will be critical for the university and higher education. I've received so much through my associations with the university and would like to give back by serving as a regent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll call it our first foursome. We'll start with Senator Bonhoff, Harriet, Paul, and Jerry.
Thank you.
Joey will be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hsu, thank you for sharing that moving family story. That was beautiful. Thank you for offering to serve. In the area that you're proficient in, that's probably the area with the most rapid change, you know, technology.
Yes.
The field of computer coding. We hear that that is the greatest demand and gives us in Minnesota an opportunity to lead. At the same time, there's these new programs that are like 12-week boot camps, very expensive, but are delivering trained people. What is the role of the University of Minnesota? How can we adapt to that changing dynamic world in a way that lets us lead and provide the workforce that's needed?
Well, I think computer programming is very important, and I think it's virtually a guarantee of a job in the future if you know how to do it. I recently learned that one of the most popular classes at Harvard is a class called CS50, which is a computer science class that virtually every student takes. And I think part of it is every student knows who Mark Zuckerberg is and Bill Gates. And I think that's why there's so much demand for the class. And it's I think it's something that everyone should learn before they get to college. In fact, at the high school where my kids go to school, they didn't have a computer programming class until I asked them why they didn't have a computer programming class. Because I went to a high school where we had one computer, but we had a computer programming class. And now we have students in schools with hundreds of computers, but they don't have a computer programming class. So I hope I'm answering your question, but I think that we do need to focus on making sure that people understand that. There are ways to do it. I think, there are online classes. In fact, the Harvard class, I believe, is mostly online, and then they have a lab where it's a 24-hour-a-day lab. If you've seen Harry Potter, it looks like one of the Harry Potter dining rooms where 24 hours a day it's set aside for people to come in and get help on how to program.
And just follow up then. Do you see a role for a shorter path to a degree in that field? And is that a university offering?
Well, I think there could be. There are a lot of things you can learn if all you want to learn is computer programming. I know that these days you can learn a lot of stuff in 4 years. You can learn, but a lot of it you can learn also in 2 years, which makes you perhaps productive even sooner. And I think that I don't know how the university does things. I mean, we're in kind of a education model here where everything's supposedly based on takes 4 years to accomplish, and sometimes more than 4 years. But I don't see a problem with having a program that could be completed in less than 4 years.
Thank you.
Harriet.
Sure. As you answered that question, I saw your consulting hat going through the thought process and thinking about that. So I'd like to touch a little bit on your consulting experience and how that would help you be a more successful regent. So I'll just ask it in that way. How would your consulting background help you be a more effective regent?
Well, I use my consulting background every day. And at Booz Allen Hamilton, we were trained on what we called a hypothesis-based methodology, where you come up with a hypothesis and you either prove or disprove it. So I think there are ways to, I mean, as a regent, I would always look at things with a critical eye to determine whether or not it's the best course of action for the entire university. And I think that there are lots of, there's lots of information provided to the Board of Regents, and I've looked at some of it, and there, it's really hard to kind of get an idea of where they're coming from in some cases if you don't understand where the information's coming from. So one of the things that's important to me is, where is the data coming from? You know, is the data accurate? Because if it's not, you might as well stop right there, because it's not worth doing analysis on bad data. Mm-hmm. And I understand the university is putting in a large and expensive computer system. It's like $85 million and counting, I think. And hopefully at the end of the day, there will be more information coming out of that system that will be helpful for decision-making going forward.
Thank you.
Paul.
In the spirit of full disclosure, this is not the first time that Michael and I have met. The two of us had the privilege of serving on President Kaler's Greek Community Task Force and have worked closely since then. But you mentioned when you graduated, electrical engineering was very highly ranked. You said number four.
Yes, number four.
I don't know where it is today. Do you have a sense of that? If it's down, what could you as a regent do to help get it back to the performance level that you enjoyed?
I think it's below number four. I mean, it's not ranked as highly today. I don't know how the rankings work. I think the rankings are all different now. This was 30 years ago. I think the people at the university need to understand how the rankings are calculated to determine whether or not they can move up in the rankings. I think there are a lot of things that are being done properly in the program, but you know, I can go back to when I was in school, and there was a year when I was a junior or senior where there was a question of whether or not the program was going to maintain its accreditation. Mm-hmm. Now, as a student, I didn't understand anything about accreditation. I understand a little bit more now, and it generally means that there were things that they weren't doing that they should have been doing in order to maintain accreditation. So I think, in electrical engineering or, at the medical school or wherever, I think there are a lot of people out there that I've heard from already that have suggested that the ranking should go up, and I would be committed to how to do that.
Thank you.
Jerry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd say, Mr. Hsu, reviewing your application, I'm very impressed. I know you're detail-oriented because you're the only guy today that got the email about which tie to wear.
Oh, yes.
But, and I say you're one of the few people that in your application listed some specific things that you think ought to be done, as a region or as the university. And one of the things I'm interested in is the cost increasing cost the university have, the increasing tuition cost. And you mentioned some specific ways of how to increase their revenue or other ways of getting it. One of the things you mentioned significantly was fundraising. Tell me any specific ideas about how do you go about that? Where do you go for that? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think fundraising is very critical. If you look at the endowments of some of the private universities and colleges in this country, I mean, I think Yale and Harvard are towards the top, and they're at about $32 billion. So those guys will survive the arms race that we're in now, and they can afford to give away free tuition, for the foreseeable future. I think the University of Minnesota needs to, and I know we're embarking on a large campaign here, but I think we need to think even bigger, because that type of campaign and that type of money, similar to the University of Michigan, is going to be required for the future. And I think one thing that's very important is you got to make sure the alumni are happy, because those are the people that donate. Now, sometimes that's sports, but sometimes it's a lot of other things. When I was living in Chicago, it was the first time in I can't remember how many years that Northwestern went to the Rose Bowl. And I remember hearing how much money was given by the – it was an astronomical figure.
It was in
the amount of money that was given after Northwestern went to the Rose Bowl. I'm not saying that that's the only way to get it done, but I'm saying that we need to do more to make sure our alumni are happy. And I've told people that it begins with making sure that they have an awesome student experience. And once the students – if they come out with a great student experience, they're going to be – writing checks, as opposed to if they come out with a poor experience. And I think part of that experience goes back to making sure they graduate on time, making sure they get jobs so they can pay back their loans. And I also think that alumni outreach is something that's very important. And I know Margaret has been very involved in the alumni association for, what was it, 25 years?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, it might take more funding of the Alumni Association to get that done. But my understanding is even today we have a small percentage of actual paying members in the Alumni Association compared to the total number of graduates that we have. And I understand we now have over 30,000 Chinese, you know, people living in China who are alums of the university, which is fabulous. Now, it's going to be a while before they can necessarily write big checks, but I think there's a potential there in the future.
And a lot of people who write small checks.
Yes, or a lot of people who write small checks, yeah.
Thank you for that answer.
Joey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you imagine yourself being a regent, when you think of doing the work of a regent, which of these two things springs to mind first? And I realize that they can both be the same thing at the same time, so you've got to pick one.
So I have a 50-50% chance.
There's no right answer.
Okay.
Do you think of serving the interests of the state of Minnesota, or do you think of remaining competitive with the university's peer institutions?
Well, that's a great question. I actually believe that the most important thing is serving the state of Minnesota, and I think that doing that will also make us more competitive against our peer institutions. The question is, what are the real peer institutions? I'm not even sure that question's been fully answered.
It's gotten a little geographically weirder.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Bert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hsu, what analysis did you go through and what factors did you look at before you, pun intended, teed up Tea Master?
Well, the true story is that I was observing my father-in-law try to get a tea time. And as a person with a technology background, I'm very keen every time I walk into a store to see what kind of systems they're running. And I've never – at that time, I didn't see a lot of systems in golf courses. In fact, there were a lot of cigar boxes for holding the cash and paper tee sheets. And so we looked for as much information as we could find, but actually at the time there wasn't a lot of information about golf courses. And it wasn't until a few years later that McKinsey and Company put out a state of golf type analysis. And I remember looking at that and thinking, I wonder where they got the information for the for this report, because there really wasn't information out there at the time. But it was something that was sorely needed, and we applied certain technologies that were very new at the time, and we actually won an award from Cisco Corporation for our use of technology in that system.
Tag onto that. So how many courses in this country use the T-Master system?
Well, we had a lot more using it before we sold the company. And we sold the company and we only bought back the Minnesota part of the company. So in Minnesota, we have about probably 75 or 80 in the Twin Cities metro area where we focus.
I think it's every course in the state, and I've looked at it. But I was just wondering nationwide how many are using the system?
ACE, well, there's variations of the system now. It might be 60% using the system, similar system. So there are still a lot of places where you can't get proper communications. That's another issue that needs to be solved by somebody.
Thank you. Margaret.
I'm glad you brought up the Chinese Minnesota tie in its 100th year. There are actually 1,600 students on campus from China. There are 8,000 alumni, but where you swell that number that you referred to, the university has been very creative in offering short course certificate programs, and they come over in just groups continuously. One last thing, then my question. I had a chance to visit the Beijing China Center on Embassy Row just this last October and met with their Beijing Alumni Society. They knew more about what was happening at this capital than most people down on Nicollet Mall. But that's a statement. But here are my two questions for you. How involved have you been with the China Center, the Chinese students, and then after you reflect on that, what's your view of globalization? Because the university set up a globalization institute. They changed it from an Office of International Affairs to a globalization institute.
Well, the first question is, I did attend the 100th anniversary event, not because I was invited or anything. I happened to show up.
Okay.
And I listened to Ambassador Huntsman's remarks, and that was fascinating to me because I do try to follow what's going on there. My my family history has I didn't tell you my mother's side of my family history, but my father was always afraid for us to go back to China. So I've never actually been there. My brother has made trips there, but when the relations were normalized with China back in the early 70s, our family was set to go back because my father was invited to go back. And we were all ready to go. And the Chinese government, the communists, who had taken away all my family's property, my dad's family, they were farmers. They owned a lot of property back then. In order to save face for my dad's potential return, they actually gave back one of their houses to the family that was still living there. But my dad chickened out at the last second, and so we didn't go.
Okay.
But they kept the house.
Oh.
So it worked out. But I think what's going on in China is fascinating. I try to keep up without having actually gone there. And I think globalization is, you know, everything's global now. And I think the more that we can do at the university to, you know, be involved in that, the better off we're going to be. And I know that some of the things that we're working on at the university here are going to be very important for the world, whether it's medical or food or, you know, whatever it is. There's lots of opportunity out there.
Just a last note to you. Whatever happens here, they need you. So I hope you get even more involved.
Thank you. Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hsu. I want to follow on Bert and Jerry's question. 18 years of your life now have been essentially, if not totally, devoted to the Tea Master and starting that up. Unpack that a little bit more for the process. We understood how you started and what the idea was, but tell us about the growth, the ups and downs, the highs, how many employees it got, the sale, the buyback. Let us know how you managed that, and you were the principal doing that, so you dealt with that adversity and success, I suspect.
Yeah, well, I had three partners initially, and we tried to do as much as we could without actually using venture money. We did raise a couple $1 million to get everything up and running. We ended up selling right before the internet bubble burst. to a company. It was actually a public company in Canada. And we had lots of relationships with various companies, including a lot of them that aren't around anymore. But the stuff that I wrote about in the application is probably the most fascinating, which is the stuff with the mobile internet, because we were on the first wave of the mobile internet, which then eventually took Steve Jobs coming back to Apple to get it to get it going really with the iPhone. But we went through a lot of ups and downs, I think, especially after we sold the company, because we found out that there was some fraud in the company that we sold it to, which eventually led to us getting the opportunity to buy back part of the company, at least in Minnesota. And at that point, we really focused on just continuing continuing that operation, but also diversifying into non-golf operations. So we actually do a lot of non-golf stuff now, including parks and rec type things. We actually process process parking citations, and so it's actually quite diversified now. And the golf part of it is a fun part, and the initial part. And we focused on golf initially because of Minnesota and the high numbers of golfers and golf courses.
How big a company and how many revenues and employees and the like?
Well, now it's a couple million dollars, but it was bigger at one time, and we're focusing on other non-golf areas now.
And where do you go from here now that I understand you're winding down in that relationship. Is that correct? And
yeah.
And where does Michael Hsu go from here?
I don't know. I've been involved in a number of other startups, and I haven't really thought through exactly where the efforts are going to go. But there's one thing for sure. I have lots of interests, and I have a lot of ideas. So,
Harriet.
Sure. I'll try to combine two questions into one here and tag on, I think, a little bit to Jim's line of questioning. In any way, does the amount of time that would be required to be a regent scare you or concern you? Would be the first part of the question. The second part would be, is there anything else about becoming a regent that concerns you or scares you?
Well, the first part, I know that there's a guideline, which is the 40 hours a month type thing that has been out there. I'm not afraid of it because I spend a lot of time. I've already spent a lot of time working on various things, which I would scale back on if I had to in order to do a good job. I think in order to do a good job, you have to try to understand how the university actually works. You have to read all the reports, and you have to probably ask for more reports than they actually give you. In terms of being scared, I don't think there's anything that scares me. There are a lot of interesting aspects to it that fall into kind of the things that I like to do. I like to meet people. I think there's a lot of that. I think there will be a lot of email coming from people that I know about whatever topic that is interesting to them, and I understand there are processes in place to take care of that. So I don't think there's anything that I'm really worried about there.
So no major concerns?
No.
Thank you.
Sonia.
Hello. You're part of a small group of early employees at Netscape. And my son was another one of them. So later I want to compare notes.
Well, I was a consultant. I didn't have the opportunity to work there.
We'll talk. We've been hearing a lot about the changing demographics, and you've referred to them. And they potentially will affect enrollment here at the university, and they affect many, many other aspects of its future. So how do you use your analytical mind, all your technological expertise, and your relative youth to help the university transform its policies, its programs, and communications in a way that it is attractive to not only students, but the many others that we want to work with?
Well, I know that the university gets about 44,000 applications a year, and there's about a 44% admit rate. Now, the question is, who's coming here and who's not, and what is it going to take to get them to come here? I've been hearing since I was in school about how there's a net outflow of talent from Minnesota. I think that's still the case. The demographics of the future are going to be, you know, in terms of number of high school graduates, the number is going down apparently from the reports that I've seen. And I believe that not only do you have to support the people that come here, but you have to make sure they understand what they're getting into when they come here. I think, you know, the diversity question is an interesting question, because I've never seen any targets. I've never seen anyone say this is what we want to have in this area versus that area. It's hard to measure whether or not you're successful if you don't have any goals. I know that, you know, you can just say we want more Asians or less Asians, or, you know, whatever the area is. But I think in terms of colleges these days, I mean, I have a college senior, so we've gotten the emails and letters and all that stuff, so I have a pretty good idea of what's out there in terms of, you know, college admissions materials and emails. And I think there actually is a big role for alumni to play in terms of funneling, just like my dad, funneling kids towards the University of Minnesota. And obviously social media is here to stay. And I think, you know, the type of social media that you have, I think is going to be very important to students. Like my son doesn't really even check his email, which bothers me because I send him a lot of email. But but I keep telling him, hey, when you go to college, you got to start checking your email more often. And he did have a summer job this summer where he actually did have to check his email, and after he finished his summer job, he stopped checking his email. So I don't know. You have to definitely keep up with the youth of today, and things are going to continue to change at a rapid rate. So I think someone needs to be aware of that.
Sure. You mentioned that you consider to be a net outflow of students from the state. Do you have an opinion as to why that might be and what the university might do about that?
Well, I don't know if net outflow is correct, but what I think is the concern of the people running admissions today is that there are a lot of talented kids in Minnesota that are leaving the state. And I think the reason for that is we just have a lot of talented students here, and they have the opportunity to go, because if you're from a middle-class family in Minnesota and you qualify, if you can get admission into some of these schools where they meet your family's financial need, it will cost you less to go to those places than to go to the University of Minnesota. That's just plain and simple. It's a financial calculation. And then if you bring in the financial calculation that relates to what happens if you don't graduate on time. If you take an extra year to graduate and you're in a major that would pay you $100,000 for that year that you would be in school, then you have to look at, well, I'm not making $100,000 and I'm paying another $15,000 to finish my degree. So it's things like that we have to look at, and it's very hard to compete with the universities that can fund 100% of your family's need if you're in the middle class or, you know, lower middle class.
Follow up?
No. I have a very short question.
Okay.
After you go around.
Pat.
we're nearing the end.
Yep.
You answered a question for Joey about are we serving the state or are we serving the university as the Board of Regents? And no.
It's whether we're competitive or whether we're serving the state.
Competitive with our peer institutions.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Or both.
So I misheard that. But so I want to go down the line of serving the state and the university's role in economic development. Not that they're a economic development agency, but certainly part of Minnesota's success to date has been because of a strong University of Minnesota. Particularly concerning to me is outstate Minnesota. What do you think the university's role should be, is, what can it do to help make sure that areas that are maybe becoming a term that we're using this week, deep rural, they're not a regional center in outstate Minnesota, they're not a Worthington, a Marshall, but they're a small town that is struggling to maintain population, and many times they aren't. They've got school districts that are shrinking rapidly. Healthcare is becoming increasingly distant, increasingly less accessible. Oftentimes, the internet is not a mainstream highway.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising. The university can do a lot to help. I mean, in the areas that you mentioned, for example, healthcare. I mean, I heard a statistic this week that was a little bit troubling. It was about how many rural dentists and doctors are going to be retiring in the near future. And that's a problem because people won't be able to get good dental care, good health care without someone like the university maybe teaming up with the state to make sure something can happen there. And it could it could be related to just simply a program where you do a loan for debt forgiveness program so you can educate people and send them out to, you know, wherever the need is in order to provide those services. But I think there's also the opportunity to bring students from those areas into the university to help train them, and maybe they'll start a company back in their hometown. You know, we're in a global world here where you can do a lot as long as FedEx and UPS show up, you know, somewhere near you. So there are a lot of things that can be done. I'm not fully aware of the needs of those areas, but I think the university. I've heard Eric Kaler talk about a number of in terms of 13.2 times. Return on every dollar that's spent on the university. So that's a pretty darn good return. I don't know how it's calculated, but if it is, you know, if it's even two times, it's still a good return. And I think, you know, the state funding for the university is very important for the future. And I mean, until the university can get its endowment up to the $32 billion mark, it's going to be required.
Margaret.
Soundbite question, soundbite answer. How important are sports to a public research university?
Extremely important.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Any closing comments?
I'd like to thank you for inviting me here today. I hope you can see that I have a deep passion for the university as well as for education. I want you to know that I'm not seeking a seat on the Board of Regents as a stepping stone to any higher office. And if selected, I would gladly serve a second term because I think once you get up to speed, you owe it to the institution to continue on and continue helping to make the right decisions for the future. If elected, I think I answered this before, but I would reduce my other volunteer commitments to make time for the regent duties. And I look forward to visiting all the other campuses and seeing all the other operations of the university that I haven't seen yet. And I promise to give it my best effort.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.